All right, great. So I'm going to be transitioning from, I guess, my role as a panelist to role as moderator. I'm going to keep this very brief so we can jump into the substance. Let me just lead off by saying, as I'm going to echo my comments that I just made here a couple minutes ago, which is kind of my everybody knows line. Right? Everybody knows that we're going to have to transition to a lower carbon platform in terms of our economy. We're going to have greater fuel efficiency, both because we need energy independence, but we also because we need to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions to keep the world from melting. And we also need to make sure that we reduce costs for many populations in terms of their energy consumption. So I'm going to take it as a given that global warming is a potential reality. I'm going to take it as a given that if the world melts, that is bad for the economy and bad for job creation. So that's going to be the starting point for this panel. And I'm going to also posit that this is a potential opportunity for us in terms of creating new good jobs. And so what I think our panel is going to discuss today is what we need to do to ensure that this is indeed an opportunity and not just a burden on the economy, on our job market, on our consumers. So let me just turn to our panelists. Let me do the quick introduction. Everyone should have a handout with bios. I'm not going to go into a full introduction of our panelists. The order we're going to go in is going to be Greg LeRoy from Good Jobs First, then move on to Jason Walsh of Green for All, then Donna Adkinson of Wider Opportunities for Women, and then Jeff Rickard of the AFL-CIO's Center on Green Jobs. So let me keep those introductions brief and turn straight to Greg.
Good afternoon, and thanks for coming out. Again, my name is Greg LeRoy, and I direct a group based here in D.C. called Good Jobs First. We also have offices in New York and Chicago. And we have two very simple messages to you and to everybody else working on green jobs right now. One is that green jobs are not necessarily good jobs. They're not born that way. They have to be made that way. And the second very simple message is, if you're trying to incentivize green jobs through tax breaks and other things, public investments, we recommend not just larding on to what's already a very overgrown regimen, but instead greening the code as it exists today. So in a study we published in February, right ahead of the Green Jobs Conference here, a study called High Road or Low Road, Job Quality in the New Green Economy, we said, what's going on? How does it look here in terms of the quality of jobs being created in existing, not proposed, but real existing green jobs in manufacturing of wind and solar componentry, in recycling, and in building construction and building retrofitting? And the answer we found was quite uneven. There's poverty wage jobs in the green economy. There are union busters in the green economy. You can't take anything for granted about the quality of a job just because it's green. We found only two things were good predictors right now about whether a green job is good. One is whether it's a union job, and we profiled three exemplary unionized green employers. Gamesa, the company that's got substantial investments in the state of Pennsylvania, the Spanish wind power company. Girding Edlund, a exemplary developer, mostly active on the West Coast, profiled one of their projects in Portland, Oregon. And NorCal, a company that contracts to provide recycling services to the city of San Francisco with the Teamsters contract. Gamesa, I should add, is the steelworkers' bargaining unit, and Girding Edlund negotiates with diverse building trades unions. The other predictor is whether or not the economic development incentives granted to the facility have what we call job quality standards. That is, does the state or city granting those tax breaks and other kinds of economic development subsidies, we use that word more often, stipulate as a quid pro quo for the tax break that the company must pay a certain wage rate and or health care and or full-time hours. And we found, looking at solar and wind componentry manufacturing companies, we found 20 that are actually up and operating and actually employing people and paying wages that we could document. 80% of those, 16 of the 20, have job quality standards, and the wage levels range as high as $22 an hour, in some cases in the absence of a union, but in the presence of a job quality standard. So there were two things that predicted good jobs. And we made diverse policy recommendations based on those findings. There's something called best value contracting, which favors high road employers, that is, employers that have good health and safety records, good labor law violations records, good training regimens, good high road practices generally, including green practices. Project labor agreements, which are ways in which, especially again for public projects, aggressive use can be made of pre-apprenticeship and labor management training programs to bring in new people into the building trades and get them a lot more experience on major construction projects. We also poked a little bit at the U.S. Green Building Council and made note of the fact that in the criteria, the diverse criteria underpinning their very successful LEED standards for rating the energy efficiency of buildings, they have yet to include any labor criteria. And we think that's an oversight and recommended some specific ways they could do that. We also recommended what we call community benefits agreements. I don't know if anybody knows what those are. These are project-specific contracts between coalitions of community groups and unions and environmentalists, with developers and companies doing big redevelopment projects to promote local hiring and higher road and living wages and affordable housing and green community practices. We recommend the Employee Free Choice Act passage as certainly a way to improve unionization in the green job sector. And we obviously hammered away on the issue of job quality standards for economic development subsidies, since we found those to be one of the two existing good predictors for good job quality and green jobs. I want to just specify that a tiny bit more here about job quality standards. The average state, you need to know, now has more than 30 different kinds of company-specific economic development subsidies on the book. They affect every kind of tax or fee that a company would normally pay to support public services. So take a windmill gearbox factory in a major industrial state in America before any kind of green jobs tax credit. It's already gone to heaven in terms of the tax code. It's not going to pay property taxes for 10 or 20 years. It's not going to pay income taxes for 5 to 10 years. It's not going to pay sales tax on building materials. It's going to get cheap land. Ironically, it might even get economic development rate discounted electricity. So how much can you really move the needle by adding on yet another layer of subsidization to a facility that's not going to pay much, is actually going to carry a negative income tax rate forward in out years? Under existing codes, just because it's manufacturing, just because it's a trophy project in today's economic development world. And it's important to remember states write the rules. Even though a lot of the deals are granted by local bodies, states control what's eligible and what kinds of tax streams can be forgiven or abated or credited. We also, this is not just a unique problem at the state level. We actually scanned during the transition period and issued a study on 5 ubiquitous federal economic development programs and found them to be not at all green either. None of them do anything to promote, for instance, job access by public transportation. None of them systematically promote even modest green building practices. So we say, you know, all these other safeguards are now quite common at the state and local level that we promote, including job quality standards. We think it's time to talk about climate quality standards in the economic development code for the existing ones that are on the books, not talking about anything new that, as in renewable credits or anything like that. So for instance, let's say if you want a property tax abatement on a commercial property, you need to either build or retrofit the LEED standards. You're only getting builders to building owners to do what they should do. It's on their own financial self-interest. Similarly, if it's an industrial facility, let's talk about closed-loop production or other emission reduction standards in order to be, you know, eligible for something like a corporate income tax credit or a property tax abatement that are the big subsidies for industrial facilities in America today. There's my contact information, and those are our two simple messages. Thanks.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Hi. My name is Jason Walsh. I'm the National Policy Director for Green for All. We are a national organization based in Oakland, California, with the mission, a very unambitious one, of creating a green economy that is strong enough and inclusive enough to lift a whole lot of people out of poverty. We talk a lot about green jobs as a way to do that. But for all of the reasons that Greg states, we're pretty careful about our definition. And we find that we have to give our definition of green jobs a lot, because it's usually one of the first questions we get asked. Right? And our definition is fairly simple. A green job is a job that preserves or enhances environmental quality and, the and is critical, provides a career track and family-sustaining wages. We do that because, obviously, the term has a lot of political traction right now. It's very popular, and it's being badly misused, both by industries that are trying to do greenwashing, but others that are simply ignoring this issue of job quality. Right? And we are very clear that we do not see day laborers installing solar panels at minimum wage with no health care benefits as green-collar workers. To us, there's a normative task here that's very, very important in terms of defining this space. If we let it get defined by others, I think we lose a term that has given us a lot of political resonance. I would also say from a definitional standpoint that there's a programmatic reason to define the term. Green jobs is nice as a term. It doesn't give you a lot to work with in terms of developing a workforce or economic development strategy. So ultimately, if whether we're talking about federal policymakers or state or local policymakers, they're going to have to drill down on which industries that are within this green space, whether it is a renewable energy industry, an energy efficiency, energy services, wastewater, environmental remediation, take your pick, have the most demand within the context of regional labor markets, are offering occupations that provide living wages or at least a career track to get to them. If states and cities and even federal agencies are not defining that, then it's our take that the workforce and economic development programs we develop are going to just be too diffuse to really make the kind of difference that we want to make. I talked with Ethan about focusing my comments on something that would not duplicate what my colleagues here are going to be talking about, since we're all sort of fellow travelers. And I want to focus a little bit on the particular political moment we find ourselves in with respect to trying to develop a green economy. And that is a moment which saw the dropping of the discussion draft of a bill authored by, well, it's not yet a bill, it's a discussion draft, but a soon-to-be bill authored by Henry Waxman of California and Ed Markey of Massachusetts, which will be the primary vehicle for energy and climate legislation in the House of Representatives, soon to be followed, hopefully, by, at the very least, energy legislation in various component parts offered at least. Most of the parts will be authored by Senator Bingaman in the Senate. But before talking about that particular piece of legislation and how I think, as progressive organizations, we need to respond to it, let me go back a year and make a proposition that I hope no one disagrees with, which is that anytime Senator Thad Cochran or Senator John Kyle stands up on the floor of the U.S. Senate and successfully positions himself as a defender of the poor, you know something has gotten badly screwed up. And that's what happened last year in the debate around the Climate Security Act authored by Senators Warner and Lieberman and then amended by Senator Boxer. Both of those senators and others who shall remain nameless were able to make the case that the climate legislation authored and subject for debate, which was I guess the first week of June, basically their messages were it's going to jack up energy prices significantly and it's going to screw poor and working people. Right? They were mostly wrong about most of their arguments. One of the more infuriating parts of the experience for me is, though, that there was a certain kernel of truth to some of what they said, which is that the legislation actually did not pay sufficient attention to how we help communities and industries and workers make this enormous transition to a green economy, and that a lot of work needed to be done on the bill. Wasn't a good enough reason to not vote on it or even to pass it. But nonetheless, it was not the kind of legislation that we needed to have moving forward. That started a conversation among a number of organizations, including our own. It involved the Center for American Progress, SEIU, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the National Hispanic Environmental Council, NAACP, where we shared our belief that climate policy, yes, certainly, it should be considered environmental policy, but that it also needs to be framed as economic policy and as civil rights policy. In some ways, some of the most significant economic and civil rights policy of our time. And if we do it right, gives us an opportunity, a really big opportunity, to advance principles of opportunity and inclusion and equity and fairness. Depending on how we price permits, how much we give away versus how much we auction, we are talking about revenue generated anywhere between $50 billion and $200 billion a year. We're talking about a fundamental shift in how we use energy, which, after all, is the very foundation of our economy in this country. That's huge. So I want to share with you, this was a sort of an agonizing process over several months, as these exercises usually are, but we actually were able to sort of craft a set of principles that all of our organizations, including a number of other national organizations that primarily identify themselves as economic organizations or civil rights organizations or faith-based organizations, this is not an effort that has involved environmental organizations, although there are allies, that we were all able to agree to. And I'll read them off, just because I think they're worth reading. Principle number one, protect people on the planet. Limit carbon emissions at a level and a timeline that science dictates. We thought it was really important that organizations that are not green groups make this statement. And certainly a big focus of ours in that statement is that if we don't do something about this, if we let the earth melt, as John described it, it's going to be poor people and people of color who are hurt, who are hit first and worst. Hurricane Katrina was, I think, evidence of that. And from that economic and civil rights perspective, we have to push affirmatively and strongly for a reduction of carbon emissions that's consistent with the science. Principle number two, maximize the gain, which we describe as building an inclusive green economy that provides pathways into prosperity for workers and for communities. There are a lot of different ways to do this, which I won't go into, that range from helping industries, existing industries retool, to helping emerging industries capture market share. There is much we can do in terms of developing pathways via education and training programs into these jobs that are created. There is much that we can do around what Greg talked about, based on the premise that green jobs will not be inherently good jobs unless we use existing policy mechanisms, whether it's community benefit agreements or targeted hiring or whatever, that we know work and have worked at the local level. So maximize the gain being the second principle. Third principle, minimize the pain. We cannot ignore the fact that there are going to be some price increases that accompany any attempt to put a price on carbon. That's one of the reasons we do it, right? So that it's sending that kind of a price signal. there is a way to both do that and to make sure that low and moderate income consumers are protected in that process. There is a notion advanced by many, a lot of them, frankly, are utility companies, saying that any way in which we do this is going to screw poor people. And that's not true. There are ways in which we can build on existing systems, whether it is the earned income tax credit system or the electronic benefit transfer system, which is set up in all 50 states. Then we can make sure that assistance is delivered in ways that are effective and efficient. Number four, shore up resilience to climate impacts. Using the example of Katrina, those who are most vulnerable to climate change have to be in a position to prepare and adapt to the changes that are already occurring and will occur, whether it's on coastal regions or low-lying cities or wherever. That process has got to start happening now. Number five, ease the transition, address the impact of economic change for workers and communities. Again, not something we can ignore. Workers in older industries that are highly reliant on carbon-based industry and the communities in which they're concentrated have got to be given the tools to prepare for a green economy. Whether it's at the individual worker level or at the community level. We have some examples to build on here. They're imperfect, but they're important. The Trade Adjustment Act Assistance Program is one of them, which in many ways is sort of the Cadillac of employment and training program, well, the hybrid of employment and training programs. If you look at it, it's sort of the suite of both tuition assistance and unemployment insurance and other benefits that it offers. We can't do any less for workers as they're making the transition. And finally, six, put a price on global warming, pollution, and invest in solutions. There will be a strong temptation here. Well, two. One temptation, and we already saw it manifest in the Lieberman-Warner bill in the Senate, is to just give a whole lot of this, of the carbon permits that are created for free to polluters. Now, we don't need to speculate in theoretical terms of what happens when this is done. It was already done in Europe, and it resulted in windfall profits for a lot of companies that didn't need the money. That's one possible dynamic. Another dynamic, and I think it is it is very politically possible, and this is an issue that splits in interesting ways politically, is sort of the cap and dividend approach, right? Which is to basically give all of the money back generated through carbon pricing back to taxpayers. We could talk about that one for a while. Our concern is that if you do it that way, there is no money left over to make the kind of investments you need in renewable energy, energy efficiency, in assistance targeted to the people who most need it, as opposed to going all the way up the tax code with no attention paid to targeting. That you're not going to be able to sort of do this delicate balance of protection and opportunity and investing in both that you need to do. Six principles. We're actually going to roll this out tomorrow. And I mentioned the Waxman-Markey bill because a lot of the things that are unanswered in that legislation right now are exactly the issues that matter most to those of us who care about making this transition successfully in a way that minimizes the pain for low-income and working folks and maximizes the gain. And so I guess in part this is an invitation to all of you, even those of you who don't really necessarily consider yourselves organizations that work a whole lot on environmental policy, to get engaged in this conversation, because it's a big one. And it's going to rely on a whole set of policies that many of you are much more familiar with than a lot of the folks who have been central to this debate to date. So on that note, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. Donna?
As usual, the microphone's a little taller than I am. Good afternoon, everybody. I am Donna Atkinson with Wider Opportunities for Women, and let me begin by thanking you for being here and sharing your afternoon with us. I know there are 1,000 things that you could be doing, and I know BlackBerries are probably going off, and those messages are stacking up at the office. So I appreciate your being here to listen and engage with us in this conversation. My particular task is to talk a little bit about women in this economy and what that may mean for them. As you may have heard me say before already today, if we are serious about creating economic security for all Americans, then fundamentally we will need to be connecting women with these green jobs. The Recovery Act does prepare for us a platform to do that, so let's take a look at it. But just to make sure that since it's afternoon and I knew that you would have already had dessert and you're probably on your third cup of coffee, go with me back just a little bit. Where did this notion of a green job come from initially? We could probably point to lots of sources, but I thought that I would just pick out one and ask you if you can tell me who said it and when. And I have cheated and put it on the slide upside down, so if you can read upside down, that's not fair. Okay? So here's the quote. Most low-income laborers are women, no shocker. Many work in agriculture, a sector extremely affected by climate change. We would like to see 20% of climate change funds aimed at women for activities such as training of young women as engineers and in environmental sciences to fulfill new skill requirements for jobs in climate change mitigation and adaptation. Who would be a likely suspect to have said such a thing? How did you know that? I'm very impressed. You can read upside down, can't you? She can read upside down. That's not fair. Actually, yes, this is the Minister of Environment from Swaziland at the opening session of an environmental forum in the beginning of 2008. So we are not the innovators in this case. In perhaps that is not due to any lack of effort on the part of many of us in this room, but just is a function of timing and political will. So let me begin by saying that connecting women to green jobs is also not necessarily an American innovation, but one in which we hope to engage dramatically and rapidly. I'm not sure that we'll see 20% of the Recovery Act's green dollars going to women, but wouldn't that be a noble goal? You've heard a little bit of discussion already about where a lot of these green jobs may come from and how to define them, and there is nothing that's been said thus far with which I would take issue. Obviously, we want to see green jobs being quality jobs, and we'll discuss that a little bit more in a while. But here's the brutal reality. We know that a great plurality, 4 out of 10 of these jobs, will be in the construction industry, and they will require some sort of application of manufacturing or construction skills. If 40% of energy is used to heat and cool buildings, then we're going to be seeing jobs that mirror that retrofit buildings, that develop the infrastructure, that create this smart grid, that look at mass transit, that feed into the manufacturing of various products. So what kind of skills will you have to have? Well, obviously, you're going to need some of those traditional manufacturing skills, but you may find that you're going to need a layer of skills added on to them. The ability to think systemically, to think from a green perspective, and we could spend another session talking about what all of that may be. But your typical community college course is going to look something like this. It may take you a couple of years to get through, and you're going to be talking as much about how the building itself works, how to analyze and diagnose energy use and patterns, looking at very sophisticated control systems. We get into things called process manufacturing, some high-tech kind of stuff, but fun and cool. And we get into another level of being able to explain what's happening to the consumers in that building. Some presentation skills may come along, and certainly those very basic math and science skills with a level of trig. Y'all remember trig? Anybody love trig? Okay, and some geometry. So What does this mean for women? Well, we know that construction jobs pay much better than the jobs that are more traditionally held by women. The Bureau of Labor Statistics tells us that two-thirds of American women are clustered in about 21 out of 500 job categories. And to put that in English, if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you can find jobs broken up into 500 categories. Of those 500 categories, you find the great majority of women in only 21 of those 500. Except for nurses and school teachers, those categories do include some of the absolute lowest paying industries: retail, personal services, food establishments, the usual suspects. So what would this mean for a low-income mother, a single mom who has one preschooler? For those of you who are not familiar with wider opportunity for women's work around the self-sufficiency standard, let me just say very quickly that it takes into account all of the costs associated with being employed: housing, transportation, food, child care, health care, out-of-pocket costs, and certain miscellaneous expenses, trying to get to a number that is much more realistic than the federal poverty measure, for example, that gives us something we can really wrap our arms around at a local level and say, in this county, in this state, this is what this family type will have to earn in order to make ends meet. So that's what I'm talking about here when I say the self-sufficiency standard. When we aggregate that data and come up with a national median self-sufficiency standard, it's in that $24,000 range for a single mother with one preschool child. 60% of women had an income below the national median. 60% of mothers with one child in this country are earning less than $24,000 a year. So what would it mean to these women if they could be trained or retrained to move into some of the areas that will offer the largest number of job opportunities? Well, looking at some of these, you can see right away that if you can learn to be a plumber or a pipe fitter, you're in the $48,000 range automatically. If you can learn to be an electrician, you're right there as well. We've already heard some discussion about the impact of these jobs being unionized, so for the sake of time, I won't repeat that point. So when we look at the jobs being created by the Recovery Act, we know, thanks to our colleagues at EPI, that we're looking at about 770,000 jobs in areas that could be considered green or have the potential to be quality green jobs, and they're listed for you. But here's the math. Without action, without someone doing something, women will get very few of those jobs. Without intervention, we would anticipate that women will get only 2.6% of those jobs. If your math is not that good at the moment, that's about 19,000 jobs out of the Recovery Act going to women in construction. Not exactly the direction that we need to be going if we're going to be talking about moving women out of poverty and taking their families with them. So how do you move people? Well, here's that transition. Part of it can be done through training or retraining, and there are lots and lots of dollars inside the Recovery Act that can be used for that. Some of them are very specific, like the $750 million in competitive grants in high-growth sectors, including green and broadband expansion. Some of them are not so explicit. There's money in there for dislocated workers. There's a large pot for the Workforce Investment Act programs. Certainly, there are resources in weatherization. And there's a $20 million competitive grant pool at the Department of Transportation for on-the-job training and supportive services. This is the only fund in the entire Recovery Act that speaks specifically to meeting the needs of either minority or women candidates for these jobs. So looking at that, in case you want more information, here's the website that you can follow to see what is happening at the Department of Transportation with this very small pool, I'll acknowledge, but a significant pool in terms of the statement that it makes at the Federal Highway Transportation Administration. Competitive grants, the purpose is very explicit. It does include a wide variety of possibilities from recruitment to pre-employment assessment, mediation, and counseling, working with employers so that they can ready the workplace and make sure that they have facilities that are appropriate for male and female employees, and that can be used to create pipeline programs that create internships, co-op education opportunities, post-secondary support activities, all sorts of opportunities that begin to build this career ladder for women to move them out of poverty and take their families with them. Not likely to happen, as I said, unless we are aggressive in our approaches and unless we are comprehensive. We're suggesting that if women are going to have access to the jobs that may become available through this greening of our economy, then we will need to have some statement of hiring goals or preferences. A lot of work was done by more women's groups than I will attempt to acknowledge because I will forget somebody and end up in trouble. There were lots of discussions with policymakers about including a very specific language that would allow states to, let me not say allow, that would require states to engage contractors who would be willing to target women in their hiring and training practices. None of that language obviously made it into the final product. However, I'll share with you some interesting news on that in just a moment. We also think that there is a real role, as I said earlier, for enforcement of non-discrimination and equal opportunity laws that are already on the books. What if that 6.9% rule were actually enforced? What if Title III was actually enforced? Certainly, we want to see some a new framework wrapped around our existing training programs, again, realizing that if we can do workforce development right under the Recovery Act, then we've created not only a great foundation from which we can move forward as a country, but we've created a great test pool for how the next WEA reauthorization may look. So thinking about things like creating pre-apprenticeship programs that take into account what the labor market looks like in a specific area, that does specialized outreach to targeted candidates, that looks at orientation programs. How do you take women and introduce them to a climate with which they are not familiar and in many instances have been discouraged from entering? As an aside there, you might look at Moore Community House on the Gulf Coast in Mississippi as a great example of this. I tend to kind of think it's cool, but they have pink tool belts. You could also look at Good Work Network in New Orleans, Louisiana, which is doing some introductory programming to not only transition from one type of skill to another, but from one workplace environment to another. Support services and stipends, thinking about things like transportation, which we have talked about so deeply today, thinking about things like childcare, which we really have not talked about an awful lot, but certainly could, and then certainly working with employers to make sure that as women begin to move into these careers that they are not met with some of the obstacles that our predecessors have met with. Obviously, it takes partnerships to create apprenticeships, and we would like to see a great deal more encouragement for sector-based partnerships involving unions and employers. So looking at what can be done very quickly at the federal level, I mentioned during the roundtable at lunch that in 1982, WANTO hit the federal books. And for a while, it was funded, and a number of programs grew out of it that linked women with non-traditional occupations that taught them to be electricians and plumbers and pipe fitters and construction laborers. And out of that, a large number of women made the shift. But over time, interest, political will, whatever the term may be that you want to use, has waned. And at present, this federal program is funded, authorized, let me be clear, authorized at $1 million. That's with an M, not a B, not a T. That's an M. And while for us as individuals, that's a tremendous amount of money, you know, walk in and hand me $1 million and see what I can do with it. As a federal authorization level, that's incredibly small. Because it has diminished to such a level, we've actually lost 20 programs in 12 states that have closed due to funding. My suspicion is that with some infusion, those programs could be resurrected, and what a pipeline that could build. Also at the federal level, the Green Jobs Training Act already exists. The Recovery Act references the sectors that it supports and suggests that those are the sectors that we want to see green jobs come out of. Well, what would happen if we actually modeled all of this work on that Green Jobs Training Act and actually had those pathways out of poverty competitive demonstration grants that are built into the law already? So our hope is that as the federal government moves forward, it will remember what it's already approved and that it will fund and enforce what it has already said should be the case so that we can have some of the data that will let us know who's moving into these occupations, who's being employed, what they're earning, and we can then go forward. You've heard enough references today already about the need to have more data, right? Please, if that's not a part of your advocacy agenda, consider adding it. We've already talked about enforcement of what's on the books from our luncheon discussion. I should have been quiet, and then all of this would be fresh, right? But let's talk a little bit about what's happening at the states very quickly. Just as a reminder, California created a Green Collar Jobs Act of 2008. I've included a couple of references here for you if you want to go actually look at the act. They were required to report by April 1 of this year on the progress of a Green Collar Jobs Council. Try to say that. And that first report is due, and a draft is now available. You can find it here. I've not found anything that particularly targets women at this point. Wisconsin, much more typical legislation, just authorizing the state to actually take those dollars and use them. And then we don't see an awful lot. Connecticut, Illinois, Massachusetts, Montana, and New Mexico are the only states which had or have legislation pending to be creative or do anything with the Green Jobs portion of the Recovery Act. If you want a copy of this for later, please let me know and I'll be happy to email it to you. I want to spend my last 60 seconds talking about Maine. Anybody been to Maine lately? Anybody from Maine? All right, you're going to love this. Maine is a model. Maine is a model right now. There is a bill working its way through the House called an Act to Create Jobs Through Investment in Green Energy, and it's in a committee. It's created a job growth initiative. There's a job growth fund. It speaks very specifically to creating career pathways and career ladders. It calls for the identification of emerging technologies and industries. Women are not identified, but the Department of Labor does have the flexibility to label them as one of the disadvantaged populations. So it strikes me that there may be some language in this bill that we can pull out and use going forward because we do have two legislative sessions at the state level to be creative. So all is not lost. All is not lost. Okay, so in the last 30 seconds, if the states can help, they can help through regulation, as we've already talked about. They can require health and retirement benefits. They can require data being displayed. They can require agencies to simply coordinate. Wouldn't that be a beautiful thing? We've heard about project labor agreements. We've heard some about pre-apprenticeship programs and training. You have an example here with the New York City procurement policies at present requiring apprentices on publicly funded projects for schools. One final thought, one more quote to leave you with. Programs which link green job training to underserved communities in both rural and urban communities present a golden opportunity to advance not only the energy security of our nation, but also the economic security of our families. Yes, I know you can see who said that. She was then Representative Hilda Solis. Now she is our Secretary of Labor, and we are very hopeful that we're going to see tremendous progress in moving women out of poverty through and into this new green economy. If you need any more information or you have questions that you're too shy to ask while you're here, here is my contact information. And again, I appreciate your time and your attention. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you. Let me mention, while we're loading this PowerPoint presentation, for people who weren't here during the morning session, EPI is today releasing two papers, one on green jobs, and a second one on transportation infrastructure and impact of jobs, the impact on jobs of investments in road, bridge, and transit construction. With both of those papers, we find, as Donna mentioned, that because of the overwhelmingly concentration of this kind of investment in the construction and manufacturing industries, these jobs are skew heavily male. And so we find approximately 80% of these jobs that would be created are male or would be going to men, while 20% would be going to women. So we very much appreciate the perspective that recognizes that we have to have an explicit part of these policies has to be non-gender blind. We have to think about the impact of women when it comes to job creation in these two sectors.
Good afternoon, everybody. I just have a short PowerPoint, probably thankfully for most of you. It's very light on graphics since the only graphic I've had time to work on since we just started the Center for Green Jobs is the logo in the corner. I thought it would be useful to start out by giving a little bit of the historical context for green jobs. By way of background, before coming to the AFL-CIO to start the Center for Green Jobs, was at an organization called the Apollo Alliance, which is a massive coalition of labor, environmentalists, civil rights groups, community activists, business, and national security folks, united around the idea that we could achieve both climate success and economic success. Now, when we started, it was 2003, and you know that group of people didn't experience much success. At the time, it was the post 9/11 era, and there was little way to talk about any of the things we wanted to talk about unless we put it in a national security frame. We started the Apollo Alliance for Good Jobs and Energy Independence. And I think, obviously, many things have happened since then. The war in Iraq, again, raised the specter of our national security and energy dependence. Hurricane Katrina brought to their attention climate change, but also the role of government. And the collapse of the global economy has further helped make us understand that what we were doing with our economy was wrong. Now, I think when we look back on history, I have this theory mostly doled out at happy hour about politics in America, and that it runs in 30-year arcs of a tension between conservatism and liberalism, or a tension between collectivism and individualism. I think we find ourselves now at the beginning of a liberal arc, at the end of the conservative Reagan era. And when we look back, I believe that Hurricane Katrina was the turning point in all of that, because it did a number of things. First, it brought our attention to the perils of climate change. Next, with the destruction of New Orleans, it brought into stark relief the struggles we were still having with inequality. The collapse of the response to New Orleans reminded everybody that we do need a government for something. And then the ripple effect that it had through our economy with the spiking gas prices showed just how tenuous our situation was. And at the time, we had been trying in vain to get legislation introduced into a very conservative Congress under a very conservative president. And it was less than a month, we saw the first bipartisan legislation on energy be introduced. And it was, by today's standards, it was nothing great, but it was a genuine bipartisan effort to try to relieve our dependence on foreign oil. After a war, a hurricane, a collapsed global economy, we're finally ready to make social progress. And we're at a new beginning where we see the role of government and we're desperate for it to take up that role. We've seen standards restored, and I think unlike the past few recoveries that this administration sees the importance of making this a job fueled recovery. Every one of us who gets up here, and if we care about justice, has to remind everybody in the crowd that a green job can be a bad job. And if I don't, someone from the audience will remind me that that's the case. And I think Greg's work on this has been important because it allows us to, point to specific examples when we go to these tables and, people who have just come to green jobs say, I do green jobs. And we can say, no, we do green jobs, and we've been doing green jobs. And from a labor movement perspective, green jobs are largely occupations that we've trained people for 100 years. Because the difference between putting in a less efficient HVAC system and a super efficient HVAC system is not very much in terms of skills, with mild upgrade. So the role of labor in green jobs, and I think the role of everybody up here, they will agree, as they've already stated, is to make sure that we firmly link the idea of a green job with a good job, and a job that pays family sustaining wages, provides health benefits, and provides for retirement security. In the terms of this recovery, we need to make sure that the investments go to those sectors that do reduce our carbon footprint, that do lead to positive environmental effects, and that also address many public purposes. The labor movement is now prepared to support this recovery with our assets, whether it's our training infrastructure or investment dollars, to make sure that we put this economy back on the high road. And we also believe that we have a role in enforcing the standards around the Recovery Act. And that's the great break with history that we find ourselves in front of now, is that we have legislation with standards. The Recovery Act, from a labor perspective, has three very important ones. One is that it provides Davis-Bacon protections to all of the Act. And this means basically there are protections that level the playing field between low-road employers and high-road employers, enforce prevailing wage and other protections. They also have Buy American provisions, and not only Buy American provisions, but Buy American provisions that are expanded over previous provisions. In the past, it was just the input into construction projects. Now it's the manufactured products used in those projects. So, for instance, when it comes to high-speed rail, it's not just the rail for the tracks that has to be made in America, but the cars that go on those tracks. And it also privileges partnerships. And I think, not only is it, it's a new day for labor in two ways. Well, it's a new day for labor that people want to talk to us, which is fun, nice. And it's a new day for labor itself in that we recognize that the world has changed and we've rushed to embrace it and move forward on trying to increase make partnerships with the Green for Alls, other community groups to try to make sure that we make this recovery an inclusive one and make what was the golden era a platinum era by making sure it expands to everybody. We've also gone a step on our own front as the money rolls down. The things that we missed at the federal level, we've tried to arm our state and local bodies with green job standards. And one place in particular that's been a headache for many of us in this world, and a pretty decent one actually, has been the weatherization project, the Weatherization Assistance Program. Prior to the Recovery Act's passage, Davis-Bacon protections did not apply to the weatherization program. Historically, this sector has created low-wage jobs with few, if any, benefits. The application of Davis-Bacon protections ensures that their wages will go up and that they're also compensated for benefits. Now it's a whole new world and throws, you know, that market into particular insanity. And it threw us into insanity because it took, you know, a week after the bill came out for even us to figure out that Davis-Bacon provisions now applied. And then we had to go across the country and convince a skeptical nation that they also applied. And, you know, as late as yesterday, I was in a room with Workforce Investment Board members from California, and they were telling me about one contractor that they had been working with who did a weatherization contractor, and he had told them, they had, the building trades had approached him about offering him help to tackle the monumental task in front of him because the program is now funded at 20 times what it was last year, going from $227 million to $5 billion. And he told them that Davis-Bacon had never applied and doesn't now, and that he doesn't need their help because he'll be able to find plenty of people to work. And I said, well, no, Davis-Bacon does apply to the WIB reps. And they're like, well, that's not what he says. And I was like, well, he's wrong. And I was like, well, that felt really good. And then the other kinds of, you know, much we've talked about PLAs and community-wide agreements, community benefit agreements to make sure that we share the prosperity of new developments and the creation of these high-road partnerships I referenced before. You know, the assets we bring are an apprenticeship and training infrastructure, 1,100 training programs strong, deep relationships with employers who do provide good jobs that we can help to invest and access the recovery money. Engagement of policies and standards to support high road growth of industries. Both, and what I mean by that is that, you know, we're heavily involved in the policy level at the federal, state, and local levels, and that we've had a history of supporting of administering supportive services for people transitioning from work back into work. So, you know, what's next for us? I mean, right now we're just totally dominated by the Recovery Act, and that can only last so long before we start worrying about what happens next. So right now we're mobilizing our infrastructure to help. We're trying to leverage new investments, and we're trying to police implementation, not only on wage and hour compliance, but, you know, all of the money that doesn't get spent, or all of the money gets spent against policy guidance, we need to make sure that it goes back so that we have a second chance at this, because this economic crisis is not yet over. And then over the long term, we'll do what we've always done, is to invest in, to promote investment in sectors that create demand for skilled workers and create and support demand for green products. Try to align our training credentialing systems so that they create pathways out of poverty. And then develop the support of institutions that make sure people can stay on that path. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. I'd like to thank all of our panelists. We're going to go into a Q&A session. I'm going to take my privilege as moderator to try to ask the first question. I suspect it's a fairly broad question, but hopefully not too broad. We heard a lot about the workforce. What kind of workforce is needed to ensure that these are, what kind of policies are needed to ensure that these are good jobs, not just any old job? And my question is this. Can we rely on currently existing programs to ensure that these are good jobs? Do we need to have new programs? So can we simply take what we have, expand on it, make it bigger, in terms of workforce training, in terms of trade adjustment assistance, or trade adjustment assistance-like programs, or do we need something wholly new to really address the job question?
Good question. I think it's a combination. I mean, I think we need to start with a recognition that we have seen a pretty unbroken record of disinvestment in our workforce investment system over the last, not just 8 years, although it was bad under the Bush administration. I mean, we're talking about inflation-adjusted cuts to key employment and training programs at the Department of Labor of about 27%. But actually, it's been bad for the last 25 to 30 years. So we're starting from a pretty low, pretty inadequate baseline. That needs to be significantly ramped up. I think we would argue, though, that to the extent we can, we need to be building on the best of the workforce education system in this country. I mean, one of our concerns and one of the things I think we want to avoid is sort of the creation of sort of boutique programs here and there in a sort of scattered way. I think we want to instead recognize the best of what's out there, and I think some of them have been talked about today, whether we're talking about sectoral approaches, good pre-apprenticeship programs, good career pathways approaches, and build on what is out there. That said, I think we need to recognize that we have a workforce system in this country that is dramatically, not only underfunded, but dramatically siloed. And so a part of the work that we need to do in making that investment is conditioning it on a better alignment and leveraging of existing programs and resources, and then, frankly, greater attention to a lot of the things that we've been talking about, which is really taking a stand on what constitutes high road economic development versus low road economic development, and making some choices about which industries will get you there versus those which will not. I think under the Workforce Investment Act, we have seen lamentably little of that, and that needs to change.
Anyone else want to address it?
I would just agree mostly with what Jason said and add some details. I mean, one specific thing that needs to be fixed, obviously, is the National Labor Relations Act, and needs to be replaced with the Employee Free Choice Act. And at the state level, about the economic development subsidies that I harped on so much, as you might guess from the title of our federal Cognate study, Uncle Sam's Rusty Toolkit, we think some of the tools just need to be thrown away. They're just too rusty, and the rest need to be sharpened up and made to serve workforce development goals and climate change goals. The trouble is siloization, as Jason put it. That is, economic development and tax break has become its own world, insulated from what it's supposed to be doing. It doesn't. It's not a means to an end. It's its own world. There's a giant tax break industry out there. There's lots of people who make their living off of teaching people how to not leave money on the table, because there's about $60 billion a year in this money, long before the Recovery Act, every year being churned out by states and cities, a lot of it very loose and very poorly monitored and ill-targeted. So getting that money turned into a means to an end of higher wages and less carbon is the way to do it.
My simple answer to your question is that we have the foundations from which we can build. Our public schools and our community colleges, working in partnership with community-based organizations, with our friends at the unions, with employers who have a conscience, can create a very strong network of policies and programs working from the grassroots level back up to Washington that can be very effective. I mentioned earlier, and I will say again, because I think it is so critically important that we remember that the Workforce Investment Act is on the table for reauthorization. And what we as thinkers, as researchers, as advocates, as actors, as service providers do within that workforce investment system with the resources provided for the workforce investment system as a whole will be of critical importance as we see what our workforce development system looks like going forward. I would not want to see that system completely unraveled. We cannot afford the transition, as it were, to languish. But rather building on some things that are already in place. For example, the last time the Perkins Act was revised, links were put in there for the first time between career and technical educators and workforce developers, who were both encouraged to work together to find measures of self-sufficiency for their students making that transition from high school to the community college. So remembering that our schools are a fundamental and integral part of this process, we do have a foundation to start on.
From a labor perspective, we feel like we have a solid foundation in our apprenticeship and training infrastructure. But you know, admittedly, that infrastructure has been largely invisible to the public system over the last 13 years, right? I mean, since the Workforce Investment Act first passed. And we see this now as a moment to engage the public system. And in part, that's a much deeper trust of the current administration than the last one. And also need to change and to understand that we need to, support this recovery with all of the resources we have.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and open up for questions. There are two microphones on either side of the auditorium. Please remember to state your name and your question and who your question is to as well.
Okay, hi. My name is Emily Noner, and I'm with Bread for the World Institute. It's a nonprofit here in D.C. It's an anti-hunger organization. My question is multi-layered here, and I would like the whole panel. It's not directed at one person, but I was at an Achieving Women's Equity event last week, and one of the things that really struck me was that women aren't losing jobs at the rate, the very severe rate as men. Now, that said, the jobs that we do hold are not paying as much as men. So given that, and given that the majority of green jobs are going to be construction services, why would we incentivize it for women to go into these jobs that are, patterns have shown are cyclical and may not be as, you know, long-lasting? I understand that these jobs are going to be great ladders out of poverty, but my concern was on the making it a career path. I was under the assumption that this was going to be a jumpstart to get the economy going again and get people working, especially the fact that we've got 20% of youth are unemployed. How long are these jobs going to last, and how long will we be able to retrofit?
We could have a conversation for about an hour over that question. And there are many answers for your many questions. 40% of those jobs are going to be in construction. That does leave another 60%. And they'll be everything from the high-level engineering to positions in paralegal services that are particular to green contracts. There'll be all sorts of positions. But when we talk about those that will be at the higher edge of incomes for those without extensive educational backgrounds who can be trained or retrained, we begin to look at those trades. Being an electrician is not cyclical. There's always work for an electrician somewhere. I've got three or four projects at my house that are languishing right now. There's always work for a plumber. Steam fitters, pipe fitters, those folks will move into jobs that can be long-lasting and sustainable. And we know that if those jobs are union jobs, then they have the staying power even beyond. What you're thinking about, I think, are the labor-intensive jobs, actually putting a building up. And that can be cyclical because obviously a building goes up, then it's done, then you move on to the next building. But we're talking about a lot of retrofitting. We're talking about going back and building by building, greening entire cities. That's not going to happen overnight. I heard some interesting numbers when the first middle class task force met in Philadelphia. And I think that it was Van who said it. So tell me the number. If we started now and we tried to retrofit every home in America, it would take 100 years to do. Something like that. So these are not jobs that are going to disappear overnight, and they are jobs which will produce a family-sustaining wage. To get to the beginning of your question, you're absolutely right. Women have not lost jobs as quickly as men in this economy. We are gradually catching up, and I suspect that we will catch up in the very near future as things begin to come on balance. But we've not lost them because we're clustered in those 21 areas. We're in services. We're in retail. We're in food production. We're in childcare, and we are at the lower rungs on the pay scale. But it will be critically important if we're going to move our entire nation to a place of economic security that we take 52% of the population in this country with us. I'll stop.
I'll just add, the growth of the built environment pretty much mirrors that of the population, so it only goes up, 1.25% a year, which means most of the work to be done here is retrofitting, and there is an enormous amount of it. And the other good news on the construction front, we think, is the density of construction right now. If you look at where home values are holding up best right now and where development vacancy rates are best in commercial, it's in areas that are dense and transit-oriented and walkable and mixed use. And if you look at we did a study a few years ago. It's on our website called The Jobs Are Back in Town. We proved that smart growth, compact design, vertical versus horizontal walkable mixed-use TOD versus sprawl creates a lot more construction work than does sprawl, because you're spending less money on land and you're spending more money on verticality and complexity. So we think if every time fuel prices go up, every time people vote with their feet and set new records on transit ridership, the resulting development patterns and construction forms are more labor intensive.
All I'll add to that is that it is not a given, even if we all recognize the value and the work that could be created by retrofitting the nation, it is not a given that we will have the policy or investment mechanisms in place to actually make that happen. Yes, we have $20 to $25 billion over the next couple of years to work with, and we've got to demonstrate that we can walk that talk. But we've got a rest of a century to work with here. And it's all the more reason, referring back to the comments I made up at the podium, that we need to be paying attention to policy vehicles that are going to be putting the structure in place that will either allow or not allow us to essentially recycle dollars in the same way that we recycle cans. I mean, that's essentially what's represented by retrofitting, right? It is, you are trying to recycle dollars in a way that has this amazing triple bottom line result of reducing energy costs, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and actually creating a bunch of good jobs if we do it right. There are major barriers we have to overcome, not least the barrier of folks, even if they recognize and are willing to figure out the whole contractor system and all the rest, that they could benefit from retrofitting their house, simply don't have the $5,000 necessary or can't get the loan necessary to actually put the money up front. There are ways of capitalizing that investment up front and letting people pay it back over time. We just haven't put put in place the mechanisms to allow people to do that.
And then just one point from related to the cyclicalness of construction work. I mean, that's something that labor unions have struggled with. I mean, you know, the building construction trades has been their sort of raison d'etre. Like it's a union construction worker, skilled tradesman's relationship is with the union, not their contractor, right? So the contractor goes to the hiring hall to hire people off the bench, but then pays into the union's pension fund, the union's health care, so that when you know the construction workers are on the bench, they still have continuity of benefits. And anticipating, you know, and accrued in such a way, anticipating only a 15-year career, because many of the for the jobs that were most taxing on people's bodies, so that you know retirements and pensions kick in at a time that's appropriate for that wear and tear.
Over here.
Yeah, my name is Merrill Guzner, and I guess for the purpose of this conversation, I'm a freelance writer. But I want to inform, ask all the panelists, by way of personal anecdote. I have very close ties with a lot of people in the Chicago area, so they both come from Chicago. The question ultimately is about the tension and time and getting the money out the door and the standards that have been written into the law. A friend of mine who is on the Obama transition team at a fairly high level at HUD and is now working in the Chicago area to try to get the weatherization and all that money out the door as fast as possible. And we were together about 3 weeks ago, and he said that they were having real problems finding the management expertise because so many of the projects are very small scale, especially when you're dealing with the residential and commercial, residential and small landlord sector, which would be a large proportion of the projects. So there is this, and of course what you have is the total or substantial collapse of the home remodeling and home construction industry, which of course has already been described, is out there crying out for work, but doesn't meet the standards that are currently in the law. So there is this tension there, and I'm curious about how you're seeing that tension being resolved over the next, really, 6 months to a year. Second question has to do with the commercial sector. Again, very personal, but I was just on the phone last night with my daughter. My daughter happens to be a construction manager for CenterPoint Properties in Chicago. They have tens of millions of square feet under contract with tenants, mostly industrial, throughout the suburban, inner suburban rings, throughout the Chicago metropolitan area. She just became LEED certified. I'm quite proud of her. And she's also laying off people in her staff because the number of new tenants who are coming into buildings, of course, is going down. And that's what they do, is they remodel buildings when they sign a long-term contract for existing buildings. And I keep sending her emails some of them from the first person I was referring to, because he's working on the transition, trying to say, you know, there should be some opportunities for a company like yours, which is the largest commercial landlord in the Chicago metropolitan area and perhaps one of the largest in the country. And she doesn't see it for their company. And so I'm just kind of curious, and Greg, maybe this goes to you to a certain extent, because there really are no incentives for helping existing in-place tenants. So again, there is this, and when I say how efficient are the buildings, we're talking about all those industrial, you know, those flat roofs when you fly into O'Hare, where you see literally millions of square feet, where energy is leaking out every conceivable pore, and a huge amount of work with struggling tenants who are having a hard time in their own businesses, trying to really save money and get a hold of this money, but there's really no opportunity there.
So, I mean, I guess the question goes to more the nuts and bolts of how you actually do this, what the possibility is.
Billions of dollars about to be spent in programs that have certain standards, and yet when you talk to people who are on the ground, what you find out is they're having a real hard time figuring out where they fit in.
So do you want to tackle this?
Yeah, those are great questions. Let me start by addressing the first one and then let others address that one as well in the second. I think we have an enormous challenge with the weatherization program in particular, and it's one that concerns me. I mean, as was stated earlier on the panel, we are moving from a program that was appropriated at about $220-230 million a year to $5 billion that they have to spend over the next couple of years. And I know when talking to some of the community action folks back in the fall, when they got an extra $250 million in the continuing resolution that was passed then, they were already nervous about blockages in their pipeline of being able to get skilled workers into those jobs. Well, you can imagine what they're talking about now. And again, as was talked about, I think, by Jeff, you know, even though the Weatherization Assistance Program is in many ways, by its measures of success, a very successful program, it has weatherized a lot of low-income homes with good rates of return. The jobs that are created are fairly low quality and are really not part of a discernible pathway. I think what we need to take this opportunity with this enormous infusion of funds into the weatherization program to do a few things. First of all, to try to restructure the residential construction labor market, essentially, which has been the home of low-road employers and bad jobs for quite some time now. And to do that both by attaching job standards like Davis-Bacon, which fortunately we have attached to the weatherization program for the first time, although it interacts with the weatherization program in some complicated ways that we still have to resolve. But it's also by inducing good contractors to actually get into that market. And the only way to do that is to do it at scale, where it's not a home here and a home there, but it is block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood. I don't know if we're really able to do that within the weatherization program right now. It's one of the reasons why I think we really have to focus in on this policy issue within the energy bill and really figure out a mechanism that allows folks to do that. If they do, then the kind of contractors that are union contractors, that are good contractors, can come into that market and really do knock this out in a way that has a lot of really good labor market outcomes. On the training side, I think we need to figure out really close partnerships, in particular between the community action agencies and labor management partnerships. That is already in process, and I'm hoping we'll be able to lift up some good models. I will say there's also going to be a low-road model out there. I think it's already starting to rear its head. I mean, I know in Indiana, Mitch Daniels, who many of you will remember from his tenure here in D.C., not a big favorite of mine, has already talked about switching the weatherization contract to the Home Builders Association, which is extremely anti-union, and has made the pledge that they can do all of the training for their weatherization workers in 3 days. So, you know, you can see where that's going, right? Anyway, I'll stop there.
Can I just add a journalistic bit of information here and encourage more? As background, so people understand, only in a very small number, perhaps 7 markets in the United States, is single-family residential construction unionized or even substantially unionized in this country. You know, Chicago, St. Louis, the Bay Area, New York, New Jersey, Honolulu. It's pretty much it. Every place else, homes are built non-union or virtually, you know, or 90% non-union. It's the most non-union and fragmented part of the construction industry in the United States. And then you take the home rehab industry as a subset of that, and then you take the home weatherization segment of the home rehab industry, and you're talking the most fragmented, lowest roaded, least skilled, completely ununionized segment of construction in the United States, and suddenly you're turning on the fire hose. And that's the problem.
Well, is the problem, let me follow up on that. I mean, is a problem that, I mean, we're turning on the fire hose. Is a problem a structural economic problem in terms of how the economy is organized, or is a problem more just being a symptom of a number of years of neglect, where we have, you know, we haven't had a fire hose, but we haven't even had a trickle. So is this more of a systematic problem, or is this more of a policy problem, or is it both?
I think it's piece of the, right. I think it's both. I mean, there's a policy structural issue where the monies are. It's an issue, not a problem. They're by statute go through the community action agencies, who have done, you know, are traditionally anti-poverty agencies who have tried to make every dollar stretch in order to make sure that they were creating energy savings for their clients. They've done the business the same way, according to the same business model for the last 30 years, and we've given them, like, you know, 60 days so far to rethink everything that they've ever done. At the same time, we've got to work with the federal government to change the way that they understand weatherization. I mean, it's, you know, going from, you know, how you weatherize a house to how do you, you know, aggregate demand so that it's attractive to, you know, high road and contractors. What are the new systems that you have to look at as part of that? I mean, those are all daunting and, you know, tasks. And then from the labor movement perspective, it is in a sector where we've had, you know, very little presence for a long time.
My only quick comment is that it's also symptomatic of how we have viewed poverty in this country and how we have viewed what it means to be low income. We, I think, have gone through a phase where poverty is one of those words that has been redefined, and the poor are there because they've chosen to be there. They've made bad choices, and as such, all the programs that are designated, quote-unquote, anti-poverty programs or programs specifically designed to target low-income families have been somewhat removed from the rest of the policy making and the policy activities going on in both Congress and in our state halls across the country. So as we take this opportunity to examine why we have some problems with weatherization, it really gives us an opportunity to step back too and ask ourselves, how is it that we look at being poor in this country? And do we really see low-income families as our next-door neighbors who need their homes rehabbed so that they can save money on their utility bills and thus be able to pay for other necessary living expenses, or do we see them as somehow removed and in need of some sort of social service?
One other background fact, too, just to clarify where I'm coming from. I'm not pointing out the low rate of unionization in residential and residential rehab just because I like unions. I'm also, it's because of the skills connection. If you look especially at who succeeds in getting women and people of color into apprenticeship programs, retaining them, graduating them, placing them, and keeping them in the industry, it's the union management partnerships that are the big success stories there. And so the fact that they're not present in most places in residential means you don't have an established skills base track record to use weatherization as an anti-poverty strategy to the kind of targeted populations you want.
And just to add on to that really quickly, I mean, that's the other complication is what is the occupation and how do you structure it? I mean, there's two ways to look at this. You can look at what the weatherization job as an entryway to an apprenticeship program. So we make it a training opportunity where we have a certified pre-apprenticeship program that is actually building the skills necessary to pass the test to get into the apprenticeship programs. Or are we talking about a new job that's a new classification? I mean, and those things are not easy to change, right? I mean, I think we're probably most geared up to go with the former, but even that is still an opportunity we didn't expect to have 6 months ago.
Since this cycle of questions started with an anecdote from Chicago, I have to close with one, which is as when the city of Chicago was putting together their climate action plan, they were forecasting the number of energy auditors they would need, which is actually, I mean, we talk a lot about most jobs, green jobs being existing occupations, and I repeat that ad infinitum, but Energy auditors actually, it's a fairly new occupation that is really sort of defining itself. What they found was, that, at least by their count, they found in the entire Chicagoland area only 17 certified energy auditors, which I think is a bit of an opportunity here, right? Both to create a pipeline of skilled workers into that occupation and to actually make sure we shape the labor market conditions around it in the right way.
That's a metro area of 8 million.
I think we have time for just one more question.
My name is Nandini Kuti. I'm an independent consultant. I would like to thank the panel today for very enlightening remarks this afternoon. My question is that much of the discussion of achieving a green economy have focused on green jobs and how we can ensure that jobs in the green economy are good jobs. But how about also focusing on the targets of the greening? Housing, for example, how about trying to ensure that green housing is also fair housing, that green communities are also inclusive and diverse communities? So would you like to comment on the value of building coalitions between the green movement and the civil rights movement?
That's a good question.
One of you guys.
Start down there?
Sure. I mean, I think I said, during my remarks that, see, this is a re-opportunity to rewrite the entire American economy and put it on a new footing. I mean, on a footing that we've seen in the past when we had a larger middle class, but that wasn't as terribly inclusive, and we have a chance to redo all of that right now. I mean, the thing that attracts me about green jobs is the sheer expansiveness of the scope of the economy that it hits. But that it's also the nexus of class, race, and environment come together to as a focal point upon which to base, create a new foundation for what we do. Most people, it drives crazy that it's sheer expansiveness, but it's, I don't like to say no.
Next Monday, we'll announce the existence of a new network of state coalitions promoting Recovery Act accountability. It'll be at a domain called accountablerecovery.org. And in the coalition that we're aligning in this national network of state actors will be all the kinds of groups we've talked about today and speaking to the issue that was asked. And I'll say this, we see the Recovery Act, and it's great that so much of the discussion has been about the Recovery Act today. People need to understand recovery.gov and the amazing amount of website traffic it's getting. You know, it's a matter of public record now that the Obama administration views this as their kind of reset button, that's their word, for transparency writ large within the executive branch and also down to the states and cities. As data wonks and activist researchers, we look at this as kind of a tectonic moment of transparency. The fact that 3,900 hits a second on that site now, people are so concerned about what the government's doing to create and retain jobs. People should be just as eager to see what their mayors and governors are doing, not just with the Recovery Act money, although that we certainly want to make sure that's true, but with all these other existing pipelines, many of which are getting thrown away right now.
Wow, no puns intended. When Wider Opportunities for Women was formed 40 years ago, it was born out of this notion that there was a large injustice occurring in this society, and that women, especially women of color, were not getting the opportunity to share in that American dream. We are joined this afternoon by a member of the Lake Research Partners team, and so if I misspeak anything, Mark, correct me. But Celinda Lake has done a lot of research around what the American dream means and who still believes that it's possible, and is it getting tougher to achieve or is it getting easier to achieve? And the numbers are frightening. That, help me, Mark, 80% plus of women in this country feel like their children are going to have a harder time in the next generation achieving the same quality of life that they have for themselves. Mark is nodding, so I got that pretty close. Thank you. If we have an opportunity as part of this green economy to paint the American dream green instead of the white picket fences, then by all means, shame on all of us if we don't get that done. My suspicion is that hidden deep within and running between the lines and between the words of everything that we've said here today, from data to wanting to see expanded pre-apprenticeship programs to wanting to connect the dots between the schools and the unions and the employers and the governors and the transparency, is all a 21st century move toward taking the American dream and the civil rights movement in this country to its next highest level. My hope is that because we have some really smart people in this room gathered here today, we'll be able to learn as much from you as you from us on how to make that happen.
Yeah, and not much more to add to that, except to say that, you know, one of our goals is to build a green economy that Dr. King would have been proud of. And that means having low-income people, people of color, women, at the table from the very beginning. We're at a moment now where we have an enormous political and economic opportunity, we have to take advantage of it.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue into our next panel. Let me wrap it up just by saying that, you know, I don't want to summarize what we've talked about. We've talked about a whole lot today. But I think the bottom line is that this seems to be a huge opportunity to talk about opportunity, that it's not just about a green job here and there, but it's about good jobs, and it's about connecting this to a whole range of other issues, and that's kind of the bottom line here. So let me thank the panelists for joining us. I think it was a great panel. Thanks.